Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Chaupada Kamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavam Shri Shri Nikam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatam Dikam Kam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvudutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Param Sahagana Raghunatam Shri Vishakam Dikam Shri Vanchikapa Chubhishcha Kripa Sundeva Chapatitam Pavanejo Vaishnavam Shri Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. August 17, 2014, Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 5, Vidura's Talks with Maitreya, Text 27. Chito Bhavan Mahatatvam Avyakat Avyaktat Kalachoditat
Tato Bhavan Mahatatvam
Avyaktat Kalachoditat
Vignan Atma Atma Dehastam
Vignan Atma Atma Dehastam
Vishram Vyanjas Tamo Nuda. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Thereafter, influenced by the interactions of eternal time, the supreme sum total of matter called the Mahatattva became manifested. And in this Mahatattva, the unalloyed goodness, the Supreme Lord, sowed the seeds of universal manifestation out of his own body. Purport. In due course of time, the impregnated material energy was manifested first as the total material ingredients. Everything takes its own time to fructify, and therefore the word Kala Choditat, influenced by time, is used herein. The Mahatattva is the total consciousness, because a portion of it is represented in everyone as the intellect. The Mahatattva is directly connected with the supreme consciousness of the Supreme Being, but still it appears as matter. The Mahatattva, or shadow of pure consciousness, is a germinating place of all creation. It is pure goodness with the slight addition of the material mode of passion, and therefore activity is generated from this point. Chito Bhavan Mahatattvam Avyaktat kalachorita vignanatmatma dehastam vishram gyanjams tamo nudha. Thereafter, influenced by the interactions of eternal time, the supreme sum total of matter called the Mahatattva became manifested, and in this Mahatattva, the unalloyed goodness, the Supreme Lord, sowed the seeds of universal manifestation out of his own body. So here Srila Prabhupada says that the Mahatattva is the total consciousness because a portion of it is represented in everyone as the intellect. When we look at the commentary of Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, he says something quite similar. He says that from Maya Avyaktat, impelled by time, undergoing transformation necessary for creation by the influence of time, Mahatattva arose. Mahan is then described, it is composed of knowledge, vijnanatma, by predominance of sattva. It is the form of excellent knowledge, it exists in partial form as chitta in all bodies. So we would like to know God, to touch God, to understand God. That's what we're doing in the practice of Krishna consciousness, that's why we've come, that's why we're practicing. We want to actually know God, like George Harrison wrote in his foreword, or whoever wrote the foreword, but anyway, that everyone is looking for Krishna, and the proof of the pudding is in the eating. We want to be able to contact God. And Prabhupada said that our perfection would be when we could talk to Krishna face to face, just like we're speaking with each other. And here we learn that there's our intellect, is a portion, our intellect, our chitta, our awareness, our mind and intelligence. It's a portion of the great consciousness of the Supreme. And this ability to touch the Supreme with our mind is mentioned in Krishna book, chapter 47, the delivery of the message of Krishna to the gopis. When Uddhava is preaching Gyan Yoga to the gopis, later on, when Krishna meets them at Kurukshetra, he's preaching Gyan Yoga. But Srila Prabhupada's writing in Krishna book, the stage in which he can understand his eternal relationship with Krishna is called Krishna consciousness. The disease condition in which he cannot understand his eternal relationship with Krishna is a contaminated stage or maya. Since the gopis are on the platform of pure transcendental knowledge, their mind is always filled with Krishna consciousness. Uddhava continued reading Krishna's message. Nothing is separate from me. The whole cosmic manifestation is situated on me. This is the basic principle. The basic principle is that everything is connected with Krishna. Everything. Therefore, it's said that one should concentrate the mind on Krishna consciousness. And as Prabhupada continues explaining in this chapter, he says, in the seventh chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, it is stated that the five gross elements, earth, water, fire, air, and sky, and the three subtle elements, mind, intelligence, and ego, are all his inferior energies, but that there is another superior energy. Therefore, Krishna is both the material and the efficient cause of everything. He is always intermingled with everything as both cause and effect. Not only the gopis, but all living entities are always inseparably connected with Krishna in all circumstances. Love of Krishna or Krishna consciousness is therefore the perfection of real knowledge in understanding things as they are. Our minds can never be vacant. The mind is constantly occupied with some kind of thought, and the subject matter of such thought cannot be outside the eight elements of Krishna's energy. So this is a very important point. Our mind and our intellect, it's always engaged in something, and whatever we're thinking about must be Krishna's energy. Prabhupada goes on to say, one who knows this philosophical aspect of all thoughts is actually a wise man, and he surrenders unto Krishna. The gopis are the epitome of this perfectional stage of knowledge. They are not simply mental speculators. Their minds are always in Krishna. The mind is nothing but the energy of Krishna. Actually, any person who can think, feel, and will cannot be separated from Krishna. So this, our mind, this thinking, feeling, and willing is Krishna's energy, and anything that it can be absorbed in is also Krishna's energy. And when one realizes this, one can be in touch with Krishna. So Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita 15:15, Matasmati Yajnanam Apohanamita, I am the source of all knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. So this is also the action of the mind and the intellect. At whatever we know, that is coming from Krishna. Sataputta Prabhu wrote an article called On Inspiration about how great scientists, musicians, and so forth would have a sudden flash of inspiration. They'd work and work and work and work and work and not be able to figure something out. Then, poof, there it would be. And we've all had that experience, that we're trying to figure something out, we're working at it, and then all of a sudden, we just know. Or we're trying to remember something. We're trying to remember, what was that? What is it that I want? What's that word? What's that idea? And then there it is. We just know what it is. And forgetfulness also. We're very fortunate that we forget pain. We can remember that we've been in pain. We can say, oh, yesterday, you know, my foot was hurting. But we can't remember the pain. The pain itself eludes us. And in fact, there's so many things that we forget. We forget our past lives and our past identities. so many things. And then actual knowledge, not just remembrance and forgetfulness, but actual spiritual knowledge, and that is coming from Krishna. Right? Riddhe Shirjunatisti. That he's in our heart and he's giving us knowledge. Of course, he's giving us knowledge even on the material level. He's telling the spider how to spin its web and the fourth generation of monarch butterflies where to migrate, although the previous third generations have not migrated. And he tells the fourth generation, now you migrate. So he's giving that kind of intelligence. He's giving the intelligence to the newborn infant, how to drink its mother's milk. He's giving us intelligence how to walk when we reach the proper age, the intelligence to be romantically attracted when we hit puberty and so forth. He's giving us that kind of intelligence, but he's also giving us intelligence how to come to him, because this mind and intellect are really connected with him. It is a fragment of him, not a separated fragment either. Not a fragment like pieces of paper torn up, but a integrated part. Therefore, he says, Tesham satata yutanam bhajatam prityapurvakam vidami buddhiyogam tam yena manu payantite tesham evanukam partam aham agyana janatamaha nasayam yatma bhavo sto gyana dipena bhashvatam. So this knowledge that Krishna is talking about in the 10th chapter is of a fully spiritual nature, unlike in the 15th chapter when he's saying Matasmati Ganama Pohanam Cha, where he's talking about every kind of knowledge, even the so-called instincts of the animals and the instincts also of the human being. But that is because the mind and intellect are him. And this is a kind of oneness when we talk about Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva. This is the kind of oneness we are talking about. As Prabhupada, we were reading just previously in the chapter of Krishna book, that Kammano Buddha Eva Cha, that Krishna is also the mind, intelligence, and the ego. In fact, Krishna, when he's talking about what he is, among fishes I am the Makara, among wielders of weapons I am Parasuram, and so forth, among weapons I am lightning. He says, among the senses, I am the mind. And Krishna particularly identifies himself with the mind. So we are dealing with Krishna, with Krishna's energy, which is, as Prabhupada would use the term, non-different from Krishna. And one can say that the whole idea of yoga is to deal differently with the mind and the intellect than a materialistic person does, to perceive the mind and the intellect in a different way. That ordinary materialistic persons, their view of the mind is as if the mind were themselves. The soul is not doing anything, as Krishna says in the 5th and 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. It's just an observer. It's just desiring. And everything is done by the modes of material nature, which is very much what's being described in these verses of the 5th chapter of the 3rd canto. Everything is done by the modes of material nature, which have taken the particular form of that person's body, the 5 knowledge-acquiring senses, the 5 working senses, the mind, intelligence, and ego. And the thoughts of the mind we consider to be ourself. It's as if we've given, as Bhaktivedanta Swami puts it, power of attorney to our mind. So, you know, power of attorney, you can give another entity the right to act as if it is you. Even sometimes that's done in a marriage, rarely, but sometimes, where one of the parties somehow can't travel to the wedding and he asks somebody to act as the groom in his place and take the vows in his place. Of course, Srila Prabhupada did that many, many times with initiating disciples, where he would ask somebody else, he would write a letter saying, I have duly accepted you as my disciple, but then he would ask one representative to accept the vows of the disciple. So this power of attorney, where someone else acts as if they were you. they can, you know, we give, if those of us who've written a living will, generally we give someone the power of attorney to make decisions about our health care if we're unconscious, if we're not able to do so for some, for whatever reason. So the conditioned living entity often gives their mind and intellect the power of attorney. Okay, you act as the self. You take the identity generated by the false ego, and you make decisions. You accept and reject according to the false ego, as if you were me, and I'll identify with you. Really, as given this example so many times, as if we're watching a film, as if we're watching a movie, and we identify with the character in the movie. We feel that character's emotions. This is the whole science of rasa, which Rupa Goswami used to explain transcendental relationships. But Bharat Muni explained the science of rasa in terms of material drama. So one is observing some drama and identifying with the character, and what the character feels, you feel as if it's your own. You imagine you are doing the activities of the character. So in a very similar way, for the conditioned soul, they are just simply the observers, and their false ego has created an identity, which then the mind and intellect make decisions and plan actions and relish sense interactions based on that identity. And all of it's happening in this material energy, just like here in this verse. So Krishna's, he's giving the seeds of life to the material energy. But the material energy, although it's spiritual, it's acting as if it's matter. So in a similar way, our body and mind and all these things are Krishna's energy. But they're acting as if they're separate from Krishna. And we're simply the observer watching this drama and vicariously experiencing the different sensations from the senses that are understood by the mind. I mean, even modern scientists say that sense perception doesn't happen in the senses. It happens, of course, they say it happens in the brain, and they don't really understand mind. But actually, it happens in the mind. We know this because dreams have sense perception. In my dream, I am seeing, I'm hearing, I may even be tasting and smelling. I'm moving my 10 senses, knowledge acquiring working senses. They're active in a dream. But are they active on the gross platform? No, not at all. If someone's sitting in the room while I'm sleeping, they see that I'm inactive. But my experience is that I'm walking, I'm running, I'm jumping, I'm eating, I'm talking, and so forth and so on. So these actions are happening in the mind, and even when I'm awake and I'm acting through the senses of this body, really everything's happening within the mind. The senses cannot perceive anything on their own. And it is the soul who's then watching this drama playing out in the mind and the intelligence and identifying with it in this false identity. So this is how conditioned souls are using the mind and the intellect. But the mind and the intellect are not meant to be used in that way. Now, they can be, just like the example that Srila Prabhupada gives many times is how the parents give toys to the child. So the parent, if the toys belong to the parents, they're purchased by the parents, they're the property of the parents. But they're given to the children to play with, and the children imitate the activities of adults with their toys. And they say, these are my toys, right? And they fight over them as if they're my toys. And they think, this is my toy to do with as I like. It's my toy to break. It's my toy to throw at my younger brother or sister, and so forth. They forget that the toys really belong to the parents. You know, when the parents say it's time to put away the toys, the children, no, these are my toys. So in that sense, the mind and intellect and body is also meant for that purpose. Prabhupada says this is the mystery of the creation. They're also designed to facilitate the false illusory enjoyment of conditioned souls who wish to use them in that way. They can be used in that way. But that's not really their ultimate purpose. The ultimate purpose of this body and this mind and intellect is meant to be harmonized with the Lord. That it is, in one sense, the Lord himself. It is non-different from the Lord and his energy. And when we use it that way, that is touching the Lord. Then we are in contact with the Lord. Does not a thing, when applied therapeutically, cure a disease which is caused by that very same thing? Therefore, all forms of yoga use the mind and the intellect to transcend the false identity with which we are using the mind and the intellect. Of course, at a certain level, one revives one's original siddhadeha, one's original form, which has its own mind and intellect, not as something separate, like in this world where the soul, the mind, the intellect, the body are all separate things, but all integrated. So one certainly transcends the material mind and intellect. Indeed, it said liberation means the dissolution of this subtle body of identification. But the process for dissolving the mind and intellect on the material level is to use it as it was originally intended and as it actually is, to use it in the service of the Lord. Indeed, it is using of the mind and the intellect in the service of the Lord that really constitutes yoga, far and above using the knowledge-acquiring senses and the active senses in the service of the Lord. I mean, using the gross body in the service of the Lord is certainly a part of bhakti yoga and a part of karma yoga also, not so much a part of jnana yoga and dhyana yoga. And we're very interested in using our gross senses in the service of the Lord because they're also Agnir Mahi Gaganamambu Marudashascha Kalastatma Manasiti Jigatrayana Yasmad Bhavanti Bhavanti Vishantiyamcha. They're also Krishna's energy, undoubtedly. Manasadeha Geha Yokichua Arpimutua Padin Nandakisha. But more important than using the gross senses, if we only use the gross senses, we are at Krishna Karmani. We are simply working for Krishna. At best, we're on the platform of Karma Yoga. At best. But beyond that is engaging the mind. Savayamana Krishna Padaravinda. It is always thinking of Krishna. Manmana Bhavamad Bhaktam Maya Shaktam Manapurti. When we engage the mind in always thinking of Krishna, the mind regains its original state. Now, in Jnana Yoga, the yogis try to control the mind, mostly through suppression and repression. They withdraw the mind from all the sense objects of the world, go to a solitary place where there's not even community. There's no family, there's no community, what to speak of internet. There's nothing to distract the mind. They remove all distractions, like an overweight person who takes all the sweets out of their house. You know, a drug addict who goes to a treatment center where there's no drugs. So this is the view of the Jnana Yogi. The Jnana Yogi engages the intellect in the philosophical aspects of Krishna consciousness, but not so much the lila aspects of Krishna consciousness, just the philosophy, just in tattva, but not in rasa, hoping to attain rasa after the perfection of tattva. But we're very fortunate that in bhakti yoga, we have so much to engage the mind with and reconnect it with Krishna, to reconnect it with its source, to use it the way that it's designed, to understand that our mind is also one with Krishna. It's not really separate from Krishna. Our view in bhakti yoga is not to hate the material energy. We don't want to hate anyone or anything. If we hate anything, we hate our desire to be a separate enjoyer from Krishna. But the material energy itself, that is Krishna's energy. Why should one hate it? Right? Sometimes a prisoner, they come to see that their prison sentence is a blessing because they can spend their time in study. There are people been put into prison who wrote books in prison because there was no distraction. And they saw the prison as a help. So one can see, just like in this human form in Kali Yuga, the human form in Kali Yuga is really not good for much of anything. And if you don't believe that, eventually you certainly will. It's really not very useful for anything other than focusing the mind and the heart on Krishna. It's not very adept in sense gratification. There are so many creatures that are far more accomplished in sense perception and sense gratification. On this planet and on the higher planets, they're have much more facility for sensual enjoyment. It's not very strong or doesn't live very long. But the human body in Kali Yuga is very, very suitable for being absorbed in the philosophy and the pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And our way of absorbing the mind in these things, interestingly enough, as taught by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur and Srila Prabhupada very explicitly, we can say it's taught by all of our acharyas, certainly taught by Rupa Goswami, etc., taught by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, but very much emphasized by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati and Srila Prabhupada, is that the way that we fully engage the mind in tattva and rasa is through kirtan. And kirtan includes both sitting and singing the holy name, chanting the holy name, and also speaking about Krishna. Machchita magata pranam bodayantas prasvam katayantas chumam nityam tushanti cha ramanti cha. And in this regard, I've been doing some research for this publishing of Raghunath Das Goswami's Manashiksha, as I mentioned in the last class. And I came across an interesting statement by Bihar Sridhar Swami, Prabhupada's godbrother, where he was saying that when one is talking about Krishna or one is in kirtan, the mind becomes naturally absorbed. So I've been really thinking about this because such has been my own direct experience, that when we're absorbed in talking about Krishna, when we're absorbed in singing about Krishna with others, talking about Krishna to others, our mind becomes naturally very absorbed. It's difficult for the mind to wander. Whereas if we were to just sit down somewhere, you know, and try to do some kind of just dhyan, it's very difficult. We do a lot of service at Radhakund and Govardhan. One time when I was at Radhakund, I met one devotee girl there who had taken initiation and instruction from some of the local Babaji's, and she was showing me her sadhana. She said that she's made a chart of the whole Radhakund, Shamakund area as it exists in apricot lila, unmanifested lila, avyaktat lila. Here we have the word avyaktat in today's verse. And she would just sit and meditate on the leelas taking place in these different areas. But if we've ever tried to do something like that, we'll find it's very difficult. If you just say, I'm just going to sit and meditate, it's extremely difficult. Maybe some people can do it. Of course, there was a whole discussion in Brihad Bhagavatamrita between Pipalai, started by Pipalai and Muni to Kopakumar, where he was saying that if you just engage in jhana, in meditation, then all of that's because the mind is the king of the senses, then everything else is included. And there was a whole discussion between the personifications of the Shastras, who interestingly enough are in female form. So the personalities who are themselves the living Shastras, are all goddesses. Anyway, they were having a debate as to whether kirtan or smaranam was the chief of the processes, and the ultimate winner was kirtan. Because in kirtan, smaranam should naturally happen. We have this experience even materially speaking. No matter how tired you are, if you're having a conversation with somebody else, you'll probably stay awake. Right? That's why when we're driving long distances, if the passenger falls asleep, we may fall asleep. But if the passenger is awake and we're having a conversation with the passenger, we're much more likely to stay awake. It's one of the few things you can do that will keep your mind awake and alert and focused. So our process for controlling the mind, for reinstating the mind in its original position, is this kirtan. Talking about Krishna, hearing about Krishna, majjhitam agata prana. Having kirtan of Krishna's name, Krishna's qualities, Krishna's form, Krishna's pastimes. And if we don't do that, if our discussion is mundane, Tasti Krishna Namadina Bhaved Grahamindriya, Sevan Mukehi Jiwado, Swayam Eva Rachata. Jiwado begins with the tongue. It doesn't begin with the mind. Maya Shakta Manaparta Manmana Bhava Madbhakto. We say, oh, very clear. The mind is what we, our whole purpose is to control the mind. So let's begin with the mind. No, we begin with the tongue. Well, how we engage our tongue and ear then naturally controls the mind. And if we try to control the mind first, chanchalahi mana Krishna, we'll find it's like trying to control a hurricane, a cyclone. In the last few weeks, we had two hurricanes that threatened the big island of Hawaii, where I am. And as usual, here on the Hawaiian Islands, the storms that come in the Pacific Ocean divert just a little ways away from the islands. They go north or south of the islands, and they divert. But no one has found a way to control these winds. Somehow the demigods are controlling them. And because of the other winds in the area and the temperature of the ocean water, these storms tend to miss the islands. Very rare. The storms threaten the islands, but they don't hit them. But nobody can control these winds. We were talking about how before these storm predictions, people didn't even know there was a storm coming because they tend to divert. But, you know, it's not that the meteorologists, just because they can look at their satellite and they even fly, I think unmanned planes into the storms, that they can control it. They can't send, you know, cool air or to change the course of the storm. Okay, well, we're going to put up some kind of a barrier. You know, even the storms that hit, we have these big mountains, Mauna Loa, Mauna Kea on the islands. If the storm does hit, as soon as it hits the mountain, it's finished. Just like when Krishna was fighting with Lord Shiva, when Lord Shiva was fighting on behalf of Banasura. So there was the torrents of rain weapon, and then there was the mountain weapon, and the mountain weapon stops the torrents of rain. So even if the rain comes, the mountains stop them, and then the storm is finished, the storm is dead. So it can be stopped with ocean temperature and other winds and mountains, but what can the humans do? The humans can just sit and watch. You know, we just go to our computers, our phones, and we just watch the storms. And we pray and we say, you know, don't come here, don't come here. And the meteorologist put up a chart. Well, looks like it might be coming. You should prepare, you should prepare, you should prepare. You know, and then, oops, diverted. But we're just helplessly watching. Is the storm going to come or is it going to divert? So it's like that with the mind. If you try for Krishna consciousness first with the mind, the mind is just like a hurricane. It's just like a great storm. And you're just watching, you know, which way is it going to go? And what's it going to do? And you're just helplessly there as it's going here and there. But if one engages one's tongue and ear in Krishna Katha, in Krishna's name, form, qualities, and pastimes, the mind will follow the speaking and the hearing. And as we do that, then we realize that the mind is already in Krishna. It was already always Krishna's. It was always Krishna's. It was never anything else but Krishna's. It was never ours. Although Krishna's allowing us to use it as a stage for our false ego dramas, that's not its ultimate function. Its ultimate function is to be in harmony with the greater citta. Vijnana atma Such an interesting word in today's verse. Prabhupada translates as unalloyed goodness. Vijnana, Atma. Vijnanatma. So, Vijnana is realized knowledge, Atma of the self. So, the mind is meant for that purpose. And then again, interestingly enough, when we use the mind for that purpose, then we actually transcend the mind. And we realize that we have a self beyond the mind. And then there is no further, the mind has then fulfilled its function. We no longer want to use it for a false identity. We've used it to reconnect with Krishna. And then it dissolves, at which point our real self is awakened. So this is our basic process of bhakti yoga, as nicely explained in a somewhat indirect way in today's verse, explaining the origin of matter and spirit and the origin of our intellect and consciousness. So questions, comments?
Gadisha, thank you for your inspiring class. You noted how the Vedas personified are in feminine form, and also we have the goddess of learning, Mother, or the goddess Saraswati. Going way back to the earlier days of ISKCON, we heard again and again, and I don't know if it came from Prabhupada's mouth or exactly the source, but, and this is controversial, and no offense is meant, quote unquote, women are less intelligent. What are we to do with that? What can we do with that?
Well, there was a family that I visit periodically as I travel around the world, and I think anybody would agree in this family that the husband was much more intelligent than the wife by any measure of intelligence. I mean, any way you'd want to measure intelligence, the husband is just extremely, extremely smart, and the wife was kind of average. However, the wife is much more serious about her Krishna consciousness than the husband, and she became very serious. She really started chanting every day and reading and so forth. And the last time I visited, it became very clear to me that she had become much more intelligent than her husband. She was much better able to control her speech, her senses, her mind. He would become angry over trifling things, and she would remain calm and equipoise. She had a joyful philosophical outlook, which he didn't have because he wasn't engaged in Krishna consciousness. And I said to her, I said, materially, you are definitely less intelligent than your husband, but spiritually, you've become more intelligent. And she laughed and she said, that's because I'm chanting Hare Krishna. So I think that Srila Prabhupada's point in bringing out the women are less intelligent on the material platform was done out of compassion. I'd like to start from the premise that Srila Prabhupada doesn't hate anyone or anything, and that Srila Prabhupada has no envy. And if we don't start from that premise, why are we following him and studying his writings and his teachings? It's like, you know, if you want to base your life around Srila Prabhupada's teachings, and one doesn't think that he's above envy and that he's full of compassion, it just doesn't make sense to me. It's interesting, there was a survey done many, many years ago of some devotee youth, and one question was, do you believe Krishna is God? And another one is, do you believe Prabhupada is a pure devotee? So many more of the youth believe that Prabhupada was a pure devotee than believe that Krishna is God. I thought that quite fascinating. Anyway, so if we accept that Srila Prabhupada is free from envy and full of compassion, then him saying things about differences of genders or races or whatever must be coming from the compassionate platform. And one reason I can understand that Srila Prabhupada says these things is to say, don't try for spiritual equality on the material platform. Try for it on the spiritual platform. It won't work materially. It will only work spiritually. The modern society all over the world is trying for equality on the material platform. It is a catastrophe. It's just a catastrophe. You cannot make men and women equal materially. You cannot make different groups of people equal materially. It just isn't real. You know, I was just reading in the 16th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita that the demons think that the different types of bodies are all just chance. But the And spiritualists knows that they're all due to karma under the supervision of the Lord. So there's different groups of bodies. You can, I mean, not only is there a group between humans and animals, but there's different types of humans. There's genders, there's races, there's varnas. And each type is good for some things and not good for other things, because materially it's like that. Whatever you're good at has a corresponding weakness. You're not going to be good at both big picture and detail. If you're good at detail, you're not going to be good at big picture. If you're good at diplomacy, you're not going to be very good at being straightforward. It's just what it is. And so you're not going to find that everybody is equal in all things on the material level. And I think this is why Prabhupada was saying it. Stop trying for it. Stop trying for material equality. It's just stupid. It's useless. You'll hit your head against the wall. Spiritually, we're all equal. Materially, we have different talents and abilities. I mean, I remember in the 70s, there was a lot of talk about how men and women were exactly the same, other than the gross reproductive function. And that's now been proved by science to be not true. Men and women's brains function very differently. And what women are good at, men are not good at, and vice versa. Of course, that's a generality. Individuals are always individuals. So I start from that premise. And Prabhupada was particularly concerned that women were not being protected. The situation of women being unprotected has increased to a fever pitch at the present time, where, as Prabhupada wrote in the 16th chapter, marriage has become an imagination in human society. And when Prabhupada wrote that, a lot more people were getting married and staying married than is true today. And today, marriage has really become an imagination in human society. Most people don't marry. If they marry, they don't stay married. The whole definition of marriage has changed. It's changed from being a sacrifice meant to produce good children and good wealth to being this sort of consensual sexual agreement. And why should there be marriage? Why should women be taken care of? Why? Well, because they need more care. I mean, even the modern feminists and the modern everybody's equal, rah, rah, rah people, you know, they all say women need special care. All of them. All this talk about equality, there's still some idea that women need special protection and need special care. Why? Because women are more vulnerable. Why? So that's there. And I see that this less intelligence applies to the fact, as Prabhupada explained it generally, that women are more interested in matter, that their spiritual consciousness is more covered. And that seems to be a fact. I mean, women are more interested than men in religion and rituals, but tend to be less interested than men in transcendence. You know, the women's magazines are mostly about food and clothes and body size and so forth. And the womanly form epitomizes the material nature. So that's what it is. At the same time, we do note that the goddess of learning and all of the shastras are feminine. And we notice that Krishna talks about feminine opulences as intelligence, fine speech, memory, and so forth. So the benefits for a woman in the womanly form, one gets the benefits of tending to follow authority and of being soft-hearted. When those are employed in Krishna's service, I give the woman a great advantage. So definitely in a womanly form, it's a lot harder to focus the mind on one point. The woman's brain is meant to be multitasking. But it is a lot easier to focus on an emotional connection with the Lord and to follow authority. So I see it like that. But when one comes to Krishna consciousness, these things are irrelevant. They're really irrelevant. And real intelligence is not what you can do in the world and how vulnerable and how need of protection you are in the world. But real intelligence is, do I connect my mind and my intelligence with Krishna? And if one connects their mind and intelligence with Krishna, it doesn't matter. One can be a vulture like Jatayu or a monkey like Hanuman. One can be a child like Dhruva or Prahlad. one can have lived a very sinful life like Jughai and Mudhai or Ajamil, or it doesn't matter. Whether whatever one's qualifications or disqualifications on the material platform, when we're connected with Krishna, then we all become supremely intelligent because we're connected with the intelligence of the intelligent. And perhaps in that regard, someone who's not very materially intelligent, again, has an advantage because there's no way they're going to claim that as their own. They're going to see that without Krishna, I'm nothing. Without Krishna, I'm simply vulnerable and helpless and in need of all sorts of facility for my care. But with Krishna, then the self becomes the master. And as Pingala says, then one can protect oneself because one is in touch with the Supreme Lord. So we could speak on this at much greater length and depth. It's a subject which, understandably, I've spent a lot of time researching and meditating on, but that's as concise of an answer that I can give at the present time. Is that all right?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Vandita, did you want to say something?
No. Thank you.
Mother Amila, I have a question about the purport.
Oh, wait, we have something here in the chat where Kandita is saying generalities and individuals, and to lump all women into one category is not good. I agree with that, and in fact, the beginning of my understanding of Prabhupada's statement about generalities of men and women was when I understood that women have varna, and that there are Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Shudra women. So a Brahmana woman, even materially speaking, is going to be much more intelligent than a Shudra man. And if you cannot put all women and all men into the same category, and indeed the scriptures don't do that, and Srila Prabhupada doesn't do that. But again, I saw that Srila Prabhupada was very concerned over what he saw as the beginning of the breakdown of the fiber of society. When Prabhupada came in the 60s and 70s, society was the very foundations of society, material society, were crumbling. And I think now we can say they're almost finished. The concept of a stable society is almost gone in most parts of the world. And so Prabhupada was speaking in these general ways, understanding that they were, Prabhupada would use the word generally to help us come back to a sane society. Yes, Ramananda Prabhu, did you have a question?
If you could just elaborate. I know that you did cover this in your lecture, but I'm still confused because in the purport it's referring to the Mahatattva as the total consciousness, mm-hmm. and also it's like a shadow of pure consciousness. Now, the living entities being para prakriti, they are conscious, but clearly Mahatattva is the apara. So how can it have consciousness?
It's such a fascinating question. There's one devotee I know who told me that before she joined the Hare Krishna movement, she was praying. And while she was praying, she had an experience of everything being spiritual and conscious, even so-called matter. And she was asking me about it in confidence. She said, you know, in the Hare Krishna movement, we teach that there's matter and there's spirit, and we teach this duality. She said, but I had an experience of everything being spiritual. So I said, well, there's also a lot of evidence in the Shastras, Sarva Kalamidam Brahma, that ultimately everything is spiritual. And I understand this teaching of duality as a stepping stone. That in the beginning we have to make this separation and say this is matter and this is spirit and there's this duality. But at a certain level of realization, it's not like that anymore. Sarva Kalamidam Brahma. We see that everything is spiritual. I give the example many times how in the beginning stages of mathematics, you have to teach that you can't subtract a bigger number from a smaller number. You can't do 3 minus 5. You know, if a 6-year-old, 7-year-old tries to do 3 minus 5, we say, no, you can't do that. You just can't do it. There's no answer. But when you're older, you do 3 minus 5. You get a negative 2. And in our adult lives, we do it all the time. It's called debt. You know, where people have negative money. It's a real part of adult life. But yet we tell the 6-year-old, you can't do that. It's not like that. So I see, to start Krishna consciousness, we have to distinguish what is matter and what is spirit. If you take a beginner and you say, everything is Brahman, everything is spirit, they won't be able to give up activities and modes of thinking which are increasing their illusion, because they won't be able to distinguish what is illusion and what is Krishna consciousness. You know, I remember in college when I was first taking up Krishna consciousness, and one of the other students said, well, I can smoke. Smoking is also spiritual. You know, anything is spiritual, depending on how I use it. And you'll end up with these kind of crazy concocted philosophies. But there are certain ways of thinking and certain ways of acting, like illicit sex, intoxication, eating, and gambling. Those ways of acting will cause us to see things as separate from God. And other ways of acting will cause us to see everything as one with God. So we therefore distinguish. These are the rules and these are the regulations. This is what is to be done and this is what is not to be done, in order to see everything as connected with Krishna. So we make that distinction. But on the ultimate level, there really isn't any distinction. You know, there's a distinction in the sense that Krishna is always a person, that he's not only in his energies. So we have that achintya bheda bheda tattva, that although everything is Krishna, everything is not Krishna at the same time. Krishna is everything, but Krishna is not everything. Maya tatam idam sarvam jagadavyakta murtina matsnani sarvabhutani nachaham te sarvastitaham. Is that all right?
That's excellent. If you have time for just one more related question to this,
sure.
Because Maitreya began this description with the Purusha avatars, and now he's talking about the Mahatattva, who continued with the creation. In regards to this, also with the Purusha avatars, the various aspects of the Supersoul, I know that you stated before that the Supersoul is not like an eternal form. I believe you made the example just like the Archa is also not an eternal form. But in order to... then that would mean that both the Archa, Vigraha, and the Supersoul are missing the component of Sat, eternity. And how could they be fully Vishnu Tattva if they're not Sat?
Well, that would be a similar question, would be how can Narayana be fully Vishnu Tattva if he's never manifests 4 of the attributes of Krishna? How can we talk about him as plenary, as full? So just because there's a certain form, a certain mood that manifests and then is not manifest, doesn't mean that it's not eternally existent. It's just sometimes manifest and sometimes unmanifest.
Oh, very good.
Is that all right?
Okay.
Just like Narayana. Narayana has all the attributes of Krishna. It's not that he doesn't have them. He doesn't manifest them. As soon as he manifests them, then he's Krishna. And when he doesn't manifest them, he's Narayana.
I see.
So it's the same person. You know, there's only one God. It's not that these are all separate forms. It's not that the Archa is a separate... It's not... We're not polytheists.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Okay. So it's eternally there, but sometimes it's shown and sometimes it's not shown. And when certain things are shown, we call it by another name.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Krishna appears in a whitish form, as we call him Balaram, he's the same person. It's not that he's a different person. And then the devotees are attracted to different manifestations of the Lord. So some devotees are attracted to the Lord as Narayana, and some devotees are attracted to the Lord as Balaram, and some are attracted to the Lord as Varaha, and so forth. That's their, or as Ramchandra, those are their particular tastes. And just because those forms are, with the exception of Balaram, perhaps, are only manifesting some of the attributes of God, it doesn't mean they don't have them. I mean, it's like if I'm at a very formal meeting, you know, I don't manifest certain of my qualities that I would show in a more intimate situation. It's not that they're not there. I just don't show them. You know, the father and mother, if they're civilized, they don't manifest in front of their children their intimate sexual activities. So their feelings are still there. It's not that they're not there. But in front of their children, they don't manifest them. You know, it's not that they're absent or that they've gone away. It's just, you know, the President Obama and his wife are sitting at a state dinner. You know, they're going to behave differently than when they're in their own private mansion alone, or even with their children, but those attributes are still existing in them. And President Obama can exist, but he can show up in your room temporarily and then leave your room, and you can say, okay, well, he's just in my room temporarily. That doesn't mean that he's temporary.
Excellent. Thank you.
All right. Anybody else?
I have some people muted. I'm going to unmute you now just in case there's anything you wanted to add.
Hare Krishna, Urmila Devi, thank you for a great class.
I
think if I understood what you were saying, there's an example of that in Chaitanya Charitamrita when Krishna is flashing back and forth between Narayan and Krishna. Narayan in front of
the gopis.
Radharani.
Right. Where he can't hold his Narayana form because Radharani is bringing out his Krishna attributes. So yeah, Narayana, Ramchandra, they are Krishna. Nisingadev, Varaha, they're all Krishna. I mean, even the Brahman is Krishna. But as Brahman, Krishna only is displaying a very few of his of himself. He's basically not displaying his qualities at all as Brahman. So, yes, thank you very much. Okay, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Jai.
Joy, all glories to Srila Prabhupada.